Blog Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, is it only fantasy? Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe? There are better days to see. So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time.
Yes, blessed souls, here it comes, the brightest light ever, which can only come from being outsourced from the eternal Torah. You're now tuned into the higher inner frequency of Soul Class 498, Heart to Heart from Jerusalem to the rest of the world, program presentation number 39. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, our next broadcast is taking place right now on June 28th. It's about 10:01 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization, which corresponds to Holy Land Jerusalem time of 5 p.m. Middle East Standard Time. Program content will focus on reading from materials accessible from the website of international human rights activist Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstuck and his wife of valor, Chana Tova, which you can access from, as we seem to be getting a glitch with our music from Rabbi Isaac Baton, here comes the time. So let's just turn that down for a second. Oi, glitches, and snitches. Okay, thank you. Sorry, Rabbi Isaac. So, blessed souls, you can get access to this website of international human rights activist Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstuck and his wife, Avalar Khanatova, by going to www.hearttoheartamerican.org. Our call-in number will be 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the eternal Creator bless and protect you and your family. And as a special guest host today, we're going to be calling in none other than Rambam teacher, student, activist for the dissemination of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Boker Tov, Don. How are you?
Baruch Hashem. Rabbi Goldstuck went away for the weekend, and he said he wouldn't be getting home this morning until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, Jerusalem time. He wanted me to call him, but I figured he can rest, and hopefully we can do another show next week with him. So I'm going to ask you to be sort of like the surrogate Rabbi Goldstuck. So you're going to be a surrogate rabbi today, Dennis. With that being said,
God points the finger at us, and we don't know why.
That's right. Our call in number again, bless those, because we're going to have a little bit more of an organic discussion, but I do want to share with you certain material in the immediate moment, and as the show develops, and hopefully about halfway the program, I want to play some interesting acoustic bluegrass by young Ari Lesser, who wrote a song about the three students who were murdered viciously in Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, and I also want to use it as a way of aligning myself with the mourners in South Carolina for that heinous crime that was committed by that distorted and evil youth. And I say it without any doubt that he deserves nothing less than the death penalty for that premeditated murder, because that goes against the Ten Commandments and also goes against the Seven Noahic Commandments, do not commit premeditated murder, and that's what he did. So another matter of concern, blessed souls, is, of course, the essential concern of this program is to share awareness concerning the human living experience of children, adolescents, young adults, and then as they get to become older adults, so they, until they become senior citizens, individuals who are uniquely capable, which the word calls handicapped, and more specifically for those who have Down syndrome, which Rabbi Goldsack likes to call Up syndrome. But today also is within less than, less than about 9 hours, 10 hours, we're going to be celebrating in the Chabad Hasidic community the birthday and the liberation of the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson of Lubavitch, who himself was incarcerated various times in his life, finally causing him to have to leave Russia, where that was the base of his operations in White Russia, in a little hamlet called Lubavitch. And he commented on his perspective of jails. Now, I bring this up because when I get up in the morning on Sunday mornings, I like to listen to a program. It's a public service program, which I wish there were more like it in the middle of the day and the drive home time. There is a program producer by the name of Salter. For some reason, his first name is slipping my mind. I think maybe Brian Salter. And he had on a lawyer, an LLP, by the name of, I think, Dan Hockenheiser, who has a law firm. And I apologize, Mr. Hockenheiser, if it's not Hockheiser or Hockenheiser. And his specialty is trying to make the public aware of the situation we have in America, namely the prison system that we have. And I want to connect that eclectically to a teaching that the Lubavitcher Rebbe once spoke in public about, is that the United States of America, the people, the good people of this country, must make a choice, not just leave it in the hands of the politicians, but the American people, via voting in those elective officials who will be sensitive to the issue, must make a choice. Do we want to develop education in America, or do we want to increase the prison system? And unfortunately, as Mr. Hockenheiser shared with the listening audience, and I was one of them, that the United States of America right now has the largest prison population of the in the world. Now, a couple years ago, we were second only to, I think it was either China or Russia, I don't remember, but now we are number one in imprisoning human beings. So unfortunately, it seems like the message of the Lubavitcher Rebbe has not been heeded to, and this is a, so to speak, a tekiat shofar, a blowing of the horn, to saying, people of this good and blessed country of America, let us consider that it is more cost-effective to invest time into the education of a child from birth until they are fully self-sufficient with the blessings of the Most High. And also, with that being said, that it is to the benefit of the few that we have a prison culture society, unfortunately, right now, which is keeps on developing, as opposed to an educationally based system. And I just want to remind everyone that I mentioned this on a previous program way back in the beginning of our endeavors here, our humble endeavors on Blog Talk Radio, Soul Class, is that the nature of a human being is to be configured to divine instruction by virtue of the fact that we have a divine image. And with that being said, now I want to, before Dennis, just please hold on. I just want to read these couple paragraphs. And Karchel Gore, the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, tried to call in and then he faded out. Hopefully, he'll call back in because I'm sure he'd like to chime in on this. So this I'm plucking from Blessed Souls, but let's just call in Karchel. Good morning, Booker T. Washington President Karchel Gore.
Booker Tov, Havarim. Mashalom Chem.
Kol B'Seder. And we also have on line Dennis Ryan. Dennis, maybe you want to send out salutations to Karchel and Karchel to Dennis.
Welcome to Karchel.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Karchel, I don't know if you've been listening, but we're going to jump right into the frying pan. Tonight we're celebrating in the Chabad Lubavitch community.
Hello.
Gentlemen, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, okay, my phone disconnected. I got a new phone. because the last phone, well, we lost Carshall, hopefully he'll call back. So I'm not. We're celebrating the freedom from prison from the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, and this is what he had to say about prison. I just call back Cartrell, and we'll get this show on the road. Cartrell, I'm sorry, my phone disconnected. Can you hear me?
Yes, I've been cut off 3 times so far.
Okay, so here we go. We're going to be. This is a teaching from the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, a direct descendant of King David and Solomon, and this is what he had to say about prison, because he himself spent time in prison when he lived in Russia, for spreading the Judaic teachings that the nation of Israel has been adhering to the past 3,327 plus years. So he writes as following: imprisonment is evil, but within it there are elements which are good, utter and absolute good. In fact, there is a dual good, since it comprises both kinds of benefit which are to be gained from suffering. The simple benefit which accrues from the lessening of fat and blood, and more importantly, the second benefit discussed above, which we're not going to go into, which was mentioned in the previous paragraph. If the suffering brought on by illness, God forbid, pain hinders a person from being wrapped up in his or her thoughts of repentance and spiritual stock-taking, and whatever else he or she is thinking about. Likewise, worries involving one's children, health, and livelihood make a person confused and preoccupied by ensnaring him in the foolishness of devising stratagems and the like. None of these advantages, however, are to be found, none of these disadvantages, I should say, however, be found in the evil of the suffering of imprisonment. In prison, a person becomes closed off from the entire turbulent and tempestuous world. Every minute is an hour, every hour is a month, and every day is a year. In prison, a person becomes acquainted with the most utmost depth of evil which malevolent geniuses can engineer. The experience gives one a limited but precise picture of what hell means and what is meant by angels of destruction. From one's first step inside and one's first glance at one's cell, all bodily desires vanish, and in the first few minutes during which one is left alone, there flutters through a ray of delight as a temporary respite from the torture and humiliation which one has undergone at the hands of the wardens and the interrogator. At one's very first attempt to reflect on what has transpired, when one has the full image of the governors of the prison clear before one's eyes, one stands overawed by the sheer depth of evil which can be found in a creature called man. One becomes minute and lonely in one's eyes as one beholds the scum of humanity. There are learned works that discuss the varying natures of different kinds of creatures and consider the cruel habits of those that prey with tooth and claw, the predators of towns and wilds, the snakes and scorpions of the desert, the fearsome denizens of the seas and the skies, and they come to the conclusion that the most pernicious beast in the whole of creation is man. But it is only when one is in prison that one comes to know the evil of this wild beast. It is there that one sees his real face and hears his vulgar voice and harsh speech. It is there with bloodshot eyes one witnesses a man's calm enjoyment from shedding blood. The most difficult time in prison is at night. For those who have already experienced the taste of prison, it is quite unnecessary to explain that daytime in prison is far quieter than midnight in the smallest of hamlets. But for those who are caught up in the hubbub of the world, it is difficult to imagine the deathly silence that reigns in prison even by day, and more so by night, when the wardens and all the officials are at rest. In the midst of this dead stillness, one hears metallic footsteps and the clatter of keys in one of the iron doors. Involuntarily, one shudders, for one knows full well what a night visit signifies. At best, it means a summons to the interrogator, with all the dire tortures that accompany it. A more dread experience is to overhear an exchange of conversation between prisoner and the warden who is escorting him to the place of execution. But then the Rebbe talks about prison at the same time, paradoxically, is a fine little retreat for private meditation. Here, one is spared the customary bother of having to close one's eyes in order that one should not see things that one ought not see, of blocking one's ears against hearing things that one ought not hear, and of guarding one's tongue from undesirable speech. This is a place where a person can rediscover his own equilibrium, where he can really make an honest self-appraisal, where he can thoroughly consider his past, joyfully accept the suffering of the present, and firmly resolve how he will leave his future as soon as the Almighty lifts him from bondage into freedom. The good which is found in the evil of the sufferings of imprisonment set a man up on a higher rung in life. It has a salutary influence on certain faculties of the soul which develop only by such means. And provided that all this is utilized for the service of God, this is the most useful experience. All of this is true of ordinary people, that tranquility is good and imprisonment is evil. But in the case of consummate tzaddikim, literally the patriarchs of the world in each generation, whatever things they encounter are various paths in the service of God. We should know that Abraham himself spent 10 years in prison, and he did this in order to trail utter self-sacrifice for godliness for Elokus. We should also mention that also Moses was in prison for 10 years by his father-in-law, who suspected that he was a spy from Egypt coming to return him to Egypt because he had run away after Paro's other advisor, Bilam, advised to throw the little Israelite babies into the water because the astrologers had seen that the Redeemer of Israel would be someone who would emerge from water. And it's known that Moses was put afloat on the Nile River, where he was picked up by the daughter of Pharaoh. Also, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe was also imprisoned in order that he should blaze the path of utter self-sacrifice in the service of God according to the teaching of Jesus. So Dennis, I've read a lot, but you know, I want to get your comment on this. And also, we don't have to go to prison to get to this level of private meditation. We can seclude ourselves when we take special moments during the day that are most privy to us being able to seclude ourselves within, so to speak, our own prison cells, which are our human bodies, which we cannot get out of our bodies until we go to the next level of life.
Well, Don, you sound like you're in the middle of a washing machine podcasting.
Cartrell, there's some sort of background noise, I think, coming out of your environment.
I'm walking down the street as I listen to you. And
okay, so that's
teacher,
the noise.
Yeah. As a teacher, some of my students either went to jail before I met them or after I met them. I went to visit one of my students at Rikers Island. I don't know how many hours I had to wait for a 45-minute visit. It was quite some time. I might have waited 4 hours just to visit with that person for 45 minutes. And we got stopped several steps along the way. They were checking to make sure we did not bring in any illegal drugs.
Right.
And by the way, my student lives a law-abiding life at this time. She made a mistake and went back to prison for a longer time, the second time. And then when she came out of prison, I happened to meet the warden. The warden came to my Booker T. Washington Club of Rikers Island one time and spoke because she's running for attorney general. And she asked, how was the person doing? And I said, well, she's living a law-abiding life. The only problem is she can't hold a job. Mm-hmm. I mean, she can only hold a job for 3 months. And what happened was she lived off her parents until her parents died. She lived off her sister until her sister retired and pushed her out the door and said, stand on your own 2 feet. So at the age of 48, she was finally on her own. And at the age of 51, she figured out how to hold a job. So last I heard, she's a law-abiding, job-holding citizen now. It only took her 51 years to figure out how to hold a job.
Yeah, it can take that time. I mean, that's one of the things that this Mr. Huckenheiser was talking about, was that when people leave jail and are thrust into the general outside community, if there is no family support, they're very likely to go back into the jail system, the prison system, or some call it the correctional institute system, which in itself I think needs a lot of correction, because one of the things he lamented about is that there is not enough constituency amongst those who are in prison, or they, for whatever reason, the families of the prisoners, or then become the ex-prisoners, they have not really petitioned or met with or brought out to the public light this discussion with elected officials who hopefully can come up with the intellectual, spiritual, and emotional courage to make laws which are fair to the ex-prisoners who many of them want to revise their whole lifestyle. I just want to share a perfect experience, and I really want to give Dennis the time to chime in on this. That I have a friend who went to jail, and because of good behavior, his sentence was cut to half its time. He was convicted of a nonviolent crime, and now he's learning to become a paralegal, with ultimately the hope of hopefully becoming a lawyer himself. And he told me that in either it was in a letter or live conversation that he saw that he recognized that God had humbled him for whatever reason. He's not going to try to understand God or why did he humble him, but he accepted it, and he realized that perhaps by him going to prison, it might have in fact saved his life from getting into more heinous matters. So, Dennis, so far, Karcher and I have dominated the conversation. I really would like to hear your viewpoints on what we've discussed.
Well, you originally said that there's a relationship. Well, no, let's go a little further back that when you introduced the subject matter, and that is that people are incarcerated. Yes, they are. But when you mentioned Russia had at one time greater amount of people in jail than we did, is because they're doing it for political reasons. And a lot of people are incarcerated because political reasons abound all over the place. So if you live in an environment that says, oh, you don't have the same thoughts as we do, and we're going to put you in jail, that's one thing. But if you commit a crime, that's another. Then the other part that is a little befuddling from my point of view, and that is the relationship of education to incarcerment. And if someone commits a crime, a heinous, I don't care what it is, but a it's hard to say a valid crime because that's an oxymoron. I'll call it a regular crime. So if someone commits a regular crime, how are they going to pay for it? What does society expect? Do you expect that we put them into class as opposed to putting them into jail? We cannot substitute forms of repentance for crimes committed by increasing the amount of education a person should be getting. So are we using education under that guise as being a punishment for crime, and that way you'll be rehabilitated? We have many, many people in jail. Yes, we do. A lot of them actually have access to academic levels and achievement. A lot of them become in-house lawyers. Some of them get different degrees here and there. I mean, that doesn't take away the black mark that they committed a crime, but at least gives them a chance. So if they didn't participate in the education and they ended up in jail, believe it or not, they have a second chance to go ahead and get a high school diploma or even get a college degree. Now, this is not widespread because not everybody can do this. So we have to be careful as to what class or categories we're talking about here. Now, the other thing you also mentioned is the standard thing of prison. That is sensory deprivation. Sentivary, you mentioned that, and even in the letter that you read from, show that you're in another world, a different environment, and there's absolutely no support. But the support is you're put in a concrete or a metal cell that takes away your normal, ordinary senses. Now you have to live more with yourself, and sometimes that's more of a punishment than actually being sentenced to go to prison. Anyhow, humans behave differently when sensory deprivation abounds all over the place, because that's a gray area and we don't know how people respond.
Okay. I'd like to respond on a couple of points, Dennis. repentance as a means of rehabilitating the prisoner, it's, you can put it in that language, but we're talking about helping them rectify. Let's say, we're talking about, say, someone who did not, let's say a person who was a robber. Now, the, yeah, we would like them to repent, but, you know, to repent to God, you know, that's something which is a very deep issue, which a person could have been turned off from God or godliness as a young child because of their environmental upbringing. But the point is the idea of repentance is not just the idea of we hope that the person will not go back to that antisocial behavior, but that they're going to seek to rectify their behavior. For example, in the Torah itself, and this is something that the Rebbe spoke about, according to scriptural teachings, you do not see any explicit command to put anyone in jail for a crime, except in the case of a capital offense case where a person is held in custody until they are brought to trial, and in the case of a manslaughter charge in ancient Israel, there were six Levitical cities where the Levites lived, where a person who committed an accidental, unpremeditated murder could go there for sanctuary and would live there until the high priest of his generation had passed away. So you might say, what's the connection? So there is some exponential connection, which is, again, this is something of Torah, so I'm going to hold by because this is the tradition we have, is that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest who was charged, or the other Kohanim who were charged with blessing the nation at the various times during the year, whether it be on a daily basis or during the Shabbat or the Yom Tovim, did not have enough in their hearts for whatever reason to bless the people with their entire heart, and therefore if we understand that human beings are all connected, that the lack of the flow of positive energy could have led to a manslaughter case. Of course, the Kohanim who did not pray with enough fervor, blessed with enough fervor, were not themselves sent to jail, but it was an instruction that we should always seek to strive to bless other people with all of our heart, with all of our efforts. Now, when, say, a person in ancient Israelite society had been caught stealing, or had run up a debt to the point they were unable to pay the debt, there was two options. If it was the year before the sabbatical year, the debt was released. So, you know, this also plays into contemporary issues, because we know that Greece is running into very big problems with the EU and the international community because of their debt. I'm not going to offer the same solution for them, but I'm just saying, just a contrast, in ancient Israel, the debts were released. The other thing is, if a person was caught stealing and admitted to the crime, they became indentured servants to the people they stole from, or they were court-appointed by the Israelite law courts to work for other people who needed people to work in their fields. Now, can we honestly say for 100% that a person who committed crime of stealing, whether it be in a hidden way or would openly rob people at knife point or spear point, whatever weapons they used back then, was he cured? I'm not going to say that they were cured unless they themselves would come forth and testify. So I'm just giving a contrast between what were the biblical standards was. It was assumed that if a person was stolen, had stolen in a premeditative, not just accidentally, but meant to take something that wasn't theirs or run into debts which they could not pay off in a certain amount of time, and the sabbatical year was still many years away. It's once every 7 years. So there was an indentured type of servitude, but for the person who received the person in servitude to him, they would be warned as well, you cannot overwork this person, which is also something, as someone myself as being part of the mental health services and social services profession, that, again, we're dealing with individuals who have a type of behavior based on a type of thought process, which unfortunately is misfiring in terms of connecting them to their true purpose in life. And rather than sticking them into or punishing them by sending them to psychiatric hospitals for long-term hospitalization or state hospitals, like you have, say, at South Beach out here off of in Staten Island, New York, that we try to work with them. You know, one more thing I just want to mention before we go on is that the Rebbe mentioned that There are those who say that it is the poverty which is causing. And the Rebbe mentioned that when you take a poor person and give them the opportunity to reinvent their current human experience, to become empowered by knowledge, this actually will motivate the poor person to say the person is more well-to-do. Of course, you know, the Rebbe is talking in the majority of cases. There always are exceptions. But to educate human beings, to empower them, where they feel that the intent of the educational process is to empower them to go out of their current mindset in order they can get stronger and get a better sense of self-esteem, and as well become contributing positive members of society where they can become educators in the French language, or educators in English. This is the focus of a Torah-based society, whether it be for Jewish people or for the children of Noah, that education is a process of empowerment. The 1 + 2 = 3 is great to know, but it's the process of how it positively affects the child or the young adult or the person who never learned math properly, even in their late teens or adolescent or young adult years, can be a life-changing experience. And that's the context I want to mention, where I believe that is the proper context which the Rebbe was addressing. America has to choose between self-empowering and then self-empowering experiences for human beings, or that they're just stuck in this deterministic mode of, if they did something wrong, well, the rest of their life will be ruined, because after all, they're from such and such a social class, or from such and such a racial class, or such and such ethnic class. Gentlemen?
I'm right here.
Hello? Dennis?
Yeah. What happens is, I think you have to put this in a heart-to-heart perspective, Don, and that is, we're all God's children. And the key word here is all. We don't care if you're left-handed, right-handed. We don't care the color of your skin. We don't care your mental levels. We don't care your physical levels. We're all God's children. And one thing that Heart to Heart points out is that some type of people need a better way of recovering from their imperfections. And that is why we have the Heart to Heart organization. Well, you mentioned prisons, that when you put people in prison, sometimes you do more harm than good. But then again, we need a way to address their special needs, so that they can recover and come back to normalcy to a certain extent. But that is the whole idea of the human experience of trying to help other people. So in the couple of cases you mentioned, you are actually indirectly proposing that there are religious examples of how to handle human behavior to a certain extent. But we in this country don't include that into our judicial system, even though we have symbols of what God represents and justice, etc. That doesn't mean we're actually practicing it. We say we're going to do it, but then again, a lot of these people are forgotten. And that's the whole concept of heart to heart, that if humans need help, we must be able to help them. And you can break it out by the different groups that need the help. So we have to have an open mind, an open heart, and a sincere objective that our fellow man, no matter what condition they're in, they are important.
True. Cartrell?
Well, Dennis mentioned the lack of education. I have a neighbor, and she and I have completely opposite political views. However, she's a defense attorney, and most of her clients who are in the criminal justice system, the schools failed them. She didn't say that they failed in school. She said the schools failed them. Now, as a teacher, I see that schools are beginning to have the attitude that we now must teach 100%. We must reach 100% of the students. And by the way, I don't know if I mentioned it, but I just passed my first certification exam to become an assistant principal. The name of the exam was called Educating All Students, because that is the current attitude. That is the current attitude in the public school system. We can't say, well, I've got a class of 30 kids, I taught 27, the other three failed, that's their hard luck. No, we don't have that mentality anymore. We must reach all of them with diversified education. And I think we should also be teaching them how to stay out of jail. I never had any children, but I helped raise my three nephews. All three of them graduated from high school on time. Two of them have college degrees. All of them have steady jobs. All of them stayed out of jail. I'm very happy for the way my nephews turned out. I once saw a documentary on television where this husband and wife had six children. Not one graduated from high school and not one stayed out of prison. They all went to prison. One got the death sentence. One was shot in the act of committing a crime. And her four remaining children are in prison. And I think she should write a book. I think this woman should write a book on how to be a lousy parent. I mean, I'm sure she has a treasury of mistakes and that she can share with the world so other parents can avoid it. I mean, she talked about, I taught my children how to cook. I taught my children how to clean. I taught my children how to do for themselves. But not one of them finished high school. Not one of them is out of prison. You got four kids left, and they're all in prison. You must have done something seriously wrong. And by the way, the woman's husband was ashamed and unable to speak on camera. He would not even speak. But, I mean, I think she should write a book on how to be a lousy parent to make sure other parents do not make the mistake that she made, whatever mistake she made. Apparently, teaching them how to cook, clean, and do for themselves was not enough. And cooking and cleaning, I'm a bachelor. I don't clean much. I don't cook much. I'm a microwave man myself.
Right.
But I got a safe job and I'm not in prison. And one last thing. I used to date a woman. And one time when I was a substitute teacher, her little brother was in my class, the class that I was watching.
Mm-hmm.
And he was maybe 12 years old. He had the mentality of a 7-year-old. I mean, talk about being a big baby. I mean, he had been left back twice, I think, at least twice. Mm-hmm. And he was about to be left back a third time. And I heard that he got older and gone to prison. For him, I think prison would be positive because he was not school material. Maybe in prison he'll finally grow up, but I don't know what happened beyond that. I speak to his other sister every now and then, but you know, her husband, you know, when I walk in the street, I see her husband lets me say hi, you know, but after you say hi, keep on walking. You know, that's how her husband is, you know.
Well, I would say this is cultural. I wouldn't, just because a child is failing in school, as you're mentioning this boy was, I wouldn't say, you know, let's make, again, it's a certain attitude which, from a Torah perspective, that we would say there's another route that, you know, every human being, even if they have some sort of developmental delay, have some sort of prowess which is unique unto them. And it's you know, unfortunately, because especially in the city schools, inner city schools are so overcrowded. There's a lot of stress and strain placed on the teacher, who now are afraid if the children don't have proper grades, they're going to get fired, even though they're giving 100%, if not 100% of 10 of their effort. So I'm saying a child like this, perhaps, you know, if there was someone doing, you know, I wish they could do assessments with children in my idealistic world, where say a child is having trouble with their social development, how do they react with animals? How do they react, you know, in farmland? How do they react by the water? perhaps that could spur some sort of development in the child, which would give the educator or the social worker or the psychotherapist or the psychiatrist or whoever is involved as an other. I don't necessarily want to call these people significant others, as usually that's relating to people in family situations or a person, whoever their most significant people are. I would hope for every human being that their most significant person in their life or significant others are not their mental health team or even their educational team. These are adjuncts. These are additional, so to speak, condiments or spices to enrich the human being's life. There are teachers, of course, that go beyond the grade, and there are therapists and social workers. I've seen it up close and personal, and even psychiatrists and even medical internists that go beyond the letter of their practice, especially when they can't bill for the services they're offering as an extra service because they really care about that person. So that's just what I have to say with that. I want to move on, gentlemen, just to bring us to where we're going to be going for the rest of the program. And I want to continue to read, from an article that was written in 1993 by Sue Buckley. And this article was entitled Language Development in Children with Down Syndrome, Reasons for Optimism. And we're going to be talking about, in this next paragraph, about language to communicate. But before they do that, I do want to take a brief, less than 3-minute break. This is a song in commemoration, painful commemoration, remembrance of the 3 young yeshiva students who were murdered last year in a heinous fashion, and also for the 9 congregants who were involved in Bible study, nothing less than Bible study, in South Carolina. I think it's at the AME Church. This is called Innocent Blood by young Ari Lesser, who's growing older and older in the sophistication and social awareness that he's projecting through his music. And I do hope and pray that Mr. Lesser, or Reb Lesser, maybe one day will be Rabbi Lesser, will get a stronger and stronger medium and opportunities to play this music, not just for the Jewish community, but for the international human family experience. This is Innocent Blood by Ari Lesser. Then we're going to go on to, after that, reading from Sue Buckley's work on the language as development relating as it relates to studies, clinical studies on children with UPS/Down syndrome. Hold on, everyone, and enjoy.
Innocent blood has been shed. 3 souls with their whole lives ahead and never made it home to their own bed. And got kidnapped and murdered instead. We talk peace, yet the war just spreads. We seek love, but we find hatred. Shedding tears, what more can be said? It won't bring back our boys from the dead. It was the very last day of June. The news came in the afternoon. 3 bodies were found concealed under the ground in an open field. I felt the tears well up in my eyes. Only thing I could do was cry, 'cause I don't understand, God, why did these 3 young men have to die? Tell me, what was the crime they done? Their lives had barely begun, and now our family is down 3 sons, and their killers are still on the run. Innocent blood has been shed. 3 souls with their whole lives ahead and never made it back to their own bed. Got kidnapped and murdered instead. We talk peace, yet the war just spreads. We seek love, but we find hatred. Shedding tears, what more can be said? It won't bring back our boys from the dead. Only thing we can do is find the wicked people behind this crime. May their evil fall back on their heads for the innocent blood they've shed. But let the souls of the deceased descend on high and rest in peace. Naphtali, Eyal, and Gilad, may they forever rejoice with God. Our hearts go out to their mothers, to their fathers, sisters, and brothers. I can't imagine what you're going through, but just know that we're crying with you. 'Cause innocent blood has been shed. 3 souls with their whole lives ahead and never made it home to their own bed. Got kidnapped and murdered instead. We talk peace, yet the war just spreads. We seek love, but we find hatred.
shedding tears, what more can be said? It won't bring back our boys from the dead.
And that was Innocent Blood by Ari Lesser. And again, we send out lamentations to the good people down in South Carolina from that heinous crime. I know the burial process started last week. And again, nine souls never went home to their bed. And what makes it, to me, all the more heinous is they were involved in Bible study. I know usually in places where people learn or commune, they call it a sanctuary for Bible study, or as we call it, Torah. It should be a place where people feel peaceful and at rest. Not that they should have to be laid to rest because some person whose anger and hatred and delusionary psychotic thinking was self-validated and validated by the various other members of, unfortunately, the distorted consciousness aspects of our society. And therefore, that's why I want to segue into this next section, how important it is for us to facilitate proper use of speech, or even for people who have trouble speaking, how we still can assist them. And specifically, as Rabbi Goldsack chose to publish this article as part of his website, hearttoheartamerican.org, that hopefully we can facilitate speech at whatever level the receiver of our efforts to facilitate and empower them, that we can help them have more control over lives. Because obviously someone who wants to take a gun and just indiscriminately start killing people, they've lost control of their life. In the case of that Mr. Ruth, that he felt that he had no more control because he felt others were controlling his life. But basically, the truth of the matter is he lost control of his own life. And for those like-minded human beings. So anyway, we're going into Sue Buckley's. It's basically reading paragraph by paragraph, then I'll turn to Dennis and Cartrell for their feedback if they wish to embellish any points that I'm reading. So we're in the section or the paragraph called Language to Communicate. Using speech, we are able to have control over our lives. We can ask for what we want or need, tell people how we feel, ask for information, share our pleasures and our worries, make friends and enjoy our social lives. If we only have limited ability to talk, we'll be more isolated from others, and our social and emotional lives become impoverished. Dennis? Dennis? Are you there? Maybe we lost Dennis. Cartrell, are you there?
I'm here, yep. Don.
Okay,
yes, Dennis. Not only speech, it's sometimes it's what's on your mind and you have to communicate. That's why deaf people use sign language. So they can also accomplish what they want to do using sign. Now, that means other people have to understand the sign. Same thing with language it is. But we do have some people who seem like they're normal, but they don't. Their speech is not what we call logical. So it's very hard to understand people who have speech ability, but if they're not using common sense and logic, then the languages are hard to apply to the thoughts that they want to come out of their mouths. So it was like a question that was presented to my daughter, who's a teacher. She's teaching disabled people. And one of the things is they said, she's normally a math teacher, how do you tell the difference between a plus one and a minus one to somebody who's mentally disabled? And she said, well, that's simple. We use a happy face for the plus one, and we use a sad face for the minus one.
Hmm.
What happens is, it isn't the language that always conveys the thought, it's what the person who's the receptor will put it in its correct position or place. So we can use speech, but that's not the only way of doing things. And we have to understand that everybody has a talent. Somewhere, somehow, that's my personal belief, by the way, everybody has a talent. We just have to tap into it. Some people it's very hard to find. Some people it's just gushing over. But yes, speech is very important, but you control the speech with your mind. And what was it? In scripture, there's been many people who say, the less words you use to get your idea across, the easier it is or the better it is, because we do have a bunch of people that use too many words, and they are wasting their talent.
Funny you should mention that, Dennis.
Yes, go ahead, Cartrell.
Funny you should mention that, Dennis, because I happen to be a stutterer. But I can control, suppress, or avoid 85% of my stuttering.
Wow.
And it took me, I have to concentrate on that, but I can get it done.
Cartrell, what empowered you to get over your the test of having a stuttering experience? Since you're a child, I guess.
It didn't start. No one accused me of stuttering until I got to high school, but in the fifth grade, I was told that I spoke too fast or mispronounced words. I spoke like Elmer Fudd. I did not differentiate between the R's and the W's. And I went to a parochial school in the third and fourth grade, where if a student made a mistake, no one corrected them. That was a school policy. If you're saying rabbit instead of rabbit, no one corrects you. And when I left that school to a fifth grade public school, they told me, you're saying the word wrong. But I don't recall being accused of stuttering until I got to high school. And when I was 23 and in the world of work, I said, I had better control this.
I just want to mention something that Dennis mentioned, that speech is not the only means. And I really enjoyed that example you gave of your daughter who's a teacher, how they would use a happy face for a plus sign and a sad face for a minus sign. That all language, whether it be spoken or sign language or the language on paper, is basically the transmission of some sort of symbolism. So the symbol generates a reaction. Because that's the way we're configured. We human beings, as well as we might say, I'm not stimulated by whatever I'm experiencing. Whether if you're not stimulated by that, something else is stimulating you. Whether to be stimulated to be not interested, or stimulated to be bored or to be daydreaming. So the symbols that surround us, whether it be the more overt expression of symbolism through human speech, or the more, actually say, visual experience of communication via reading or using our listening, you know, listening skills. All of this is based on the science of symbolism, which is a whole endeavor unto itself. But I just want to add that because I once learned about this a while back. So I want to move on to the next paragraph, Language for Learning, where Sue Buckley takes the following position based on some clinical studies or a clinical study. Once a child begins to understand spoken language, the scope for learning about the world expands enormously. We can talk to the child about everything we do. We talk about what we are going to do and what we did yesterday or last week. We can talk about many things that are outside the child's range of actual experience, such as what does the postman do at the office of the mail of the post office. What does the postman do at the post office when he sorts out the mail? Or what does a doctor do when working at a hospital? What do astronauts do, or why the wind blows? Many psychologists have emphasized the importance of language for teaching concepts and ideas, the tools for thinking, to children. This was in a study reported by Vygotsky, 1986, and Brun, 1983. Any child with a delay in learning to communicate in a language is going to be seriously disadvantaged in being able to gain knowledge about the world. Dennis?
Well, if you can't handle the language, the mind can. The problem is how to put the mind in the correct sequence with the speech. We mentioned the word education, but the beginning of education begins with your parents. You pick up what your parents say from their mouth because you know it's coming from their mind. So as children, we try to imitate what our parents do. When we get to actual school, that's when they start refining this, because then they're telling you about the rules and limits. But it's how you're accepted by your parents is your whole life is going to be beholden to that. because if they think you have a speech impediment, whether it's a lisp, whether you name it, are they going to accept it or try to wean you out of that? I don't know. But there's always something going on, and whether or not you can speak, it's a question in your mind, do you really think you're communicating or people can't understand you, even though you think you're saying the correct language? But we have people who pick up that talent once, while others are deprived because they're saying, I don't know what that means when you put all those words together, or you're giving me too many words at one time. So we have to allow that humans are imperfect, and those imperfections can be overcome if we handle them in a correct way. If you ignore them, I don't know what happens because you go off into the deep end into a gray area. But it all starts with your parents, with the language you use, because who else are you going to communicate with when you're born?
True. I have a question for you, Cartrell. Of the children or the adolescents you're dealing with, the young adults, who are skipping school, have you seen any connection between them lacking a certain level of personally age-appropriate language expression? Or is that it could be a person could be very verbally not challenged, but the opposite, very verbally excellent, and yet still they find a reason why they're cutting from school. What has been your experience?
I have seen some children with age inappropriate behavior and age inappropriate tastes. You know, I mean, I see. Sometimes when I visit the home of a high school student and they're watching cartoons, I mean, and not only are they watching cartoons, they're watching baby cartoons. I said
right.
to myself, this kid is mentally not, hasn't gone very far. And mm-hmm. when I taught adults, the adult that went to prison, I noticed that her taste in entertainment was very childish. She really loved gangster rap music. And when I would talk to her about adult things, she had no idea what I was talking about. And she was 29 when I met her.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to her about cartoons, that she knows about. I mean, at age 29, she's still watching kiddie shows. And her response would be, those shows are for anyone who wants to watch them. But,
right. But I'm saying, when you've caught these kids, if you walked into their homes, or, I mean, are they apologetic? Can they elucidate why they're not going to school? Or they just kind of become overwhelmed and intimidated of expressing what their feelings are, why they're not interested in going to school?
In the high school level, there's 1,001 reasons. In the lower level, it's they're usually out because of asthma.
Uh-huh.
I just applied for, because I've been working in elementary schools the last 2 years or so, and I applied to work in high schools again, and I got my wish. I'm going to be working in 3 high schools and 2 middle schools.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that I like. And there's 1,001 issues in the high school where they're not coming to school. They could have fallen behind. It's too hard to catch up. They just don't care anymore. They think it's an honor to be a failure. You see that a lot. They think
mm-hmm.
failing is good. Success is bad. I just
mm-hmm.
saw the video of some failures, kids are being on the honor roll, you know. Whereas these dummies, they brag about how low their grades can be. And I must say, I have seen grades so low that I said to myself, well, I can understand your sense of accomplishment because it's hard to get below a 40 in any subject.
Right.
40 is supposed to be the lowest grade you can get. And some men get even lower than that. So, I mean, if that's your idea of accomplishment, you know, breaking the barrier, breaking the bottom barrier. Yeah, but you, you laugh to keep from crying so he doesn't feel bad. You know.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
Sometimes we have to look at the whole spectrum, and that is we do have kids who are ahead of the normal curve. And what happens is they're put off by education and schooling because they've already figured a lot of this stuff out. So in class, they're bored, and they can act just like the kids who say, I don't have to use my mind because it's not required here. Well, then you can see where the low and the high get mixed in between there. But we've had lots of many cases in the United States here where people have dropped out of high school, dropped out of college, and what do? They became multimillionaires or billionaires because their talent was something they had, and they weren't going by the rules of society because they were creating shortcuts for themselves. And sometimes we have kids who are not motivated by school or educational type of things because they have a talent for something else. So we have to look at the whole spectrum of the human condition, and that is that we have all sorts of things, and we have to bring them together and hopefully standardize something because we have a hard time keeping them all together. So we can come up with different reasons, but there's a lot of people who have been successful for maybe the wrong reason. But here we are trying to say that you must learn what we're teaching you in school. And some of them say, why? If they don't get a worthwhile answer, you may not motivate them.
True. Very good point. On the one side, some people raise their concerns about, you know, the children having such access, or the young adults, adolescents, to all these smartphones and iPhones. But at the same time, too, if they're using it in a positive way, it's spurring, at some level, you know, independent thought and a sort of self-dependence. Now, then they have the shock of having to return to a classroom either the next morning or later in the day. And sometimes it's a little bit hard, but, you know, we hopefully should be making efforts, those of us who are adults, whatever level of society we're part, whatever stratum of society we're located on, to try to educate them that it's not a contradiction to be able to use your smartphone to access information or text your friends and being in a classroom setting, because there is a time when you have to, you know, when you're studying for your test to get ready for the finals or the, what do they call, the Regents here in New York State or New York City. There's a point where you have to do it on your own. I mean, you go to sleep by yourself, you go to the bathroom by yourself, you eat by yourself. No one can do these activities for you. But I guess because it's so stimulating, the process of engaging with like these miniaturized forms of computerized luxuries, which I like to call them, then you know, sometimes the children or the adolescents are in fact kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I know too, I remember several years ago reading a study that in Israeli high schools, not all of them, but in some of them where they were studied, that there were actually some emotional delays in the Israeli high schoolers because they were spending so much time at the computer. It was at the expense of them doing less socializing and developing what appeared to be the features of some sort of, you know, mental health issue in potential, or sometimes even manifesting, you know, delusionary type or even semi-psychotic thinking. So these are very serious matters, but I want to go further into reading another portion of the article by Sue Buckley. And again, this is going back to 1993. If there's been more modernized information, then we accept that as a fact. But back then, in 1993, this was sort of like breakthrough material, and I think that's what Rabbi Dr. Goldsack incorporated into his website, again, which you can access by going to hearttoheartamerican.org. The links between language and cognition, as Sue Buckley continues, children with Down syndrome are expected to show cognitive delay, to be slower in developing their awareness and understanding of the world, and to think, reason, and remember. This cognitive delay may be in part in the consequence of the language learning difficulties. Any serious language delay will inevitably result in increasing cognitive delay, as language is such a powerful tool for gaining knowledge and for understanding, thinking, reasoning, and remembering. Conversely, the more we can do to overcome the children's language learning and speech difficulties, then the better equipped they will be to learn and improve their cognitive abilities. Now, I would just like to suggest that, you know, I've noticed, and I'm sure Rabbi Goldstock will back me up on this, is that individuals with Down/up syndrome are very, very responsive to music. They also will engage in drawing pictures. They also will respond in molding clay or something that's very malleable, like silly putty, whatever. And you can learn by observing them how they react to music, how they react to drawing, and for those who can write, how they react when giving something to write. Because they're also communicating. But if we segue those type of experiences, which are uniquely empowering for the Down/up syndrome human being, then we are actually, unfortunately, contributing to them a cognitive delay, which has already been identified as the lack of language expression is connected to some sort of level of cognitive delay. So we as members of society, and we're being site-specific with Down/up syndrome children or human beings, to show that we have to have a certain flexibility to go to, as they say in the modern expression, to think outside the box. Dennis?
Yes, what happens is modern science believes, and a lot of people do, that when one of your senses is not working well, other senses will increase their intensity,
and you
will have overlapping recognition by your mind. Now, you mentioned music. When people turn their head, they're reacting to vibrations that they're feeling. There's good vibrations and bad vibrations. We even had songs about that in the 50s and the 60s. But anyway, also, the other thing that's a telltale sign in a lot of people is their eyes. Are they looking at you? Are they looking at something else? Do they have dead eyes? If you bring up a new subject, does it look like all of a sudden their eyes have a little sparkle or they widen? So we have where these other senses have to work together, and they can be used to draw a profile about a person. So if you think they're unresponsive, they're dead because they're not drawing the same picture you want them to, well, maybe drawing isn't their thing. Maybe it's something else. So again, we have to look at the spectrum of the human condition. And all their senses are active, but they may not be working on the same level. But the one thing that we do know is that they have a mind, and we have to keep on having the patience that we can activate their mind so that they can respond. Because if we're going to measure them on their response, we got to give them a fair chance of responding to stimulation.
Sounds great. It's been interesting listening. I have to move along now. But you'll hear from me next week, okay?
Hopefully, Cartrella, and have a pleasant day. And may you go from strength to strength in all your matters of connected to the Booker T. Washington Business League. Would you like to give out your phone number for the Business League that people can contact you in the New York City area or either in the outer environments to try to collaborate with you to try to help empower more human beings in the New York City and even the outer environs of this country?
Okay, my number is 718-670-3717.
Okay, could you repeat it one more time?
718-670-3717.
Okay.
Be well, Quattro.
Okay, Heathrow. Okay. So, Dennis, we're going to move on to language for learning, language for cognitive functions. And she's quoting from a piece of writing by someone by the name of Gather Cole in 1993. Psychologists have also drawn attention to the way in which language and speech are used for cognitive functions. Once we have begun to master a language, we think in terms of words. We reason, recall, and do mental arithmetic in words, either silently or aloud. For example, according to our current understanding of short-term memory function, which is essential for most mental processing, It is based on silent speech and develops as a children's speech facility increases. Storage and recall from long-term memory is also dependent on the organizing the information on the basis of meanings conveyed by language, i.e. grouping items into similar classes such as fruit or clothes. Currently, there is a considerable interest in the interrelationships between the development of speech, language, and memory abilities. Any thoughts on these matters, Dennis?
Yes, Kim, that's the interrelationship of what makes a human being, because we have our heart, which represents our feelings. We have a mind that does analyzation, memory, and directs all our body's operations except for the non-reflexive functions. But that's the unit that we're talking about here. So you can't really comment on that until you get into the practice.
True. The next short, terse paragraph from Sue Buckley is learning to talk. As she continues, the focus of this article is on learning to talk, and as well, learning to talk is not the only form of communication available to us, as we talked about earlier in the program. Though it is the most powerful, and research suggests that it is built on babies' experience of communicating in the first year of life in several ways. So let's go into the first year, communicating before talking. Babies, brand new babies, souls fresh from heaven, as we like to say, have experience of communicating in the first months of life, and they soon learn that they can control their parents' behavior, for instance, by smiling and crying. They begin to understand people, their behavior and moods, and to know when someone is happy, sad, or angry from the clues provided by tone of voice, facial expression, and behavior. This is the first step on the pathway of social and emotional development. Dennis?
Yes, what happens is we don't do it by speech alone. If you look at someone's eyes, you can tell if they're excited, happy, or sad usually, especially if there's a tear coming out of it. That's not due to happiness sometimes. But we look for facial expressions, just like we use grunts, groans, and other things as we get older. It isn't just total speech. It's will make a sound of reflecting how we feel. Somebody says, oh, we're going to have to go over this, and someone says, oh. Well, that sound alone tells you that they're not pleased with it. But then again, everything in life is not going to be pleasing. But there are sounds that people make, grunts, it just keeps on going. And there's no place for that in the language. But the human condition says, I can do anything I want to communicate if I want to communicate. And we end up doing that.
True. Beautiful, Dennis. Now, early conversations. Well, I want to mention one thing. If anyone's involved for a long time in the field of psychology or mental health services, I am, you'll probably come across two versions of the same type of message. Basically, there's one form where you see different depictions of smiley faces, you know, that cylindrical icon. But there's probably 25, if not 30 different types of emotional reactions communicated through that cartoon depiction of the smiley face, smiley icon. Then you have pictures of either children or adults on that same type of poster. We're like, this is the face of feeling. Someone's feeling sad, or someone feeling mad, or someone feeling happier, or someone feeling, you know, ambivalent. And, you know, these posters are usually in the offices of mental health professionals or people involved in psychology, social workers' offices. And as a worker, you recognize these faces, and sometimes you study those pictures, because sometimes by recognizing those faces, just as a simple reminder of these are the different types of expressions that people can communicate, you can cue into the person you're collaborating with, because the language, what they just mentioned, but we didn't necessarily talk about it yet, is the language of the body language, the posture, the eye contact or the lack of eye contact, the smile or the frown, the tear coming out of the eye because of joy, or the tear coming out of the eye because of pain, or confusion, ambivalence. There's all different types of languages, but if we were to enumerate all the different forms of language, that would be a basis of like a whole series on Soul Talk, which could be certainly discussed under the prism of Torah, and of course, according to science and the sociology, anthropology, because different cultures have different ways of expressing their unique forms of body language. So getting into this next section called Early Conversations, once babies begin to smile, parents begin to have interactions with them that are like conversations. We smile, we go coo, coo, and talk to the baby, and tend to do this in a conversational style, waiting for the baby to smile, gurgle, or babble after each one of our actions. These exchanges are usually a source of pleasure to both partners, meaning the child being one partner and the parent or the adult being the other partner, and strengthen the emotional bonds. If adults spend time in these baby conversations, it is the child's first experience of the pleasure of talking with an adult, even though they're just going goo-goo gaga. And they begin to understand that being able to communicate is fun, and that it is worth becoming skilled at this activity. They also learn to look, listen, and take turns in the conversation, all essential skills for effective communications when talking. Dennis?
Yes, what happens is, on a rudimentary basis, when a parent talks to a child, it's taken on a rudimentary basis. In other words, you're adding to the child's memory, intellect, etc., whatever is there. So that accumulates. But the toughest thing to do is to try to explain when you're having conversations that there are contradictory moments. In other words, humans, being imperfect, we're not always logical. So sometimes we'll do strange things that seem like they're contradictory, but they're really not because they weren't intended. So sometimes kids have a hard time understanding adults because adults have a feeling for this. An example is if one person, adult to adult, curses the other, but they do it with a smile on their face. Now, how can you read that? How can you understand that? Were they really being stupid? Were they really being silly? Or did they have a specific intention behind it that you don't know because you can't see the, you can't read it on their face and the words are not explaining it? So we have to allow for that that strange part of the human condition that sometimes is unpredictable, sometimes it happens at the wrong moment, and sometimes gives the wrong impression. So the problem is that the adult understands it, but the baby or the kid that's growing up sometimes doesn't understand that because they'll bring up to a parent, how come you said this yesterday, but then you said it doesn't apply to this today, even though it's the same thing? So
right.
We have where the baby's logic can be quicker or purer than the adult. So we have to be careful of how we explain these concepts as opposed to just using words.
True. Okay, let's move on to the next section. Initiating conversation. This is written by Sue Buckley. Research has shown that babies with Down, and as Rabbi Goldsack is prone to say, Down/Up syndrome, while a little later to smile and enter into these conversations, are as interested as ordinary babies in these social games and spend the same amount of time engaging adults in this kind of activity in the middle of the first year of life. For review, see Berger from an article she wrote apparently in 1990. However, these studies have shown that when ordinary babies begin to spend proportionally more time exploring the visual world, the babies with Down/Up syndrome do not do this to the same extent. They are still more interested in people, nor do they move on to use eye contact to engage the adult in their activities at the end of the first year of development in a way which has been described as referential eye contact. So that's interesting. On the one hand, that other babies will be spending more time looking outside their world, it seems like the Down syndrome or Up syndrome children are focusing on the world that is right in front of them when it comes to person-to-person relationships. And I guess that's, I'm going to throw something out there which I might be mistaken, but I'm just going to suggest it. Perhaps this is why when you interact with someone with down/up syndrome, blessed souls, you see that they are very people friendly. And they really are existentially living in the moment when they interact with you. It's not like they're, you know, we have a saying in the Hasidic world that, you know, because unfortunately because of the frigidity which has entered into modern civilization, it used to be when you said Shalom Aleichem to someone, it was with a warm handshake, it was with an eye-to-eye contact, it was with a hug and sometimes a kiss on the cheek. Now it's like Shalom Aleichem, Tesem Koshola, meaning how are you doing, hello and see you later. But by the down/up syndrome human being, they're really focusing on you because this is the way they developed as little children, and eventually they will develop, if they're given the right environment to develop all their potentiality as much as they can, they will start to focus more on the outside world, as Robert Goldzik has reported to us week after week in terms of how his natural-born daughter, Suri, Chaya Suri, is doing in her taking classes and getting involved in dance and art and music and learning how to socialize, eventually getting to date to get married, and his adopted son, Mendy, who to him is no different than any flesh and blood child that he or his wife of Valer Khanatova have, that Mendy is also moving on. Now, I can tell you this, that Mendy, from my interacting with him, is a lot less verbal than Chaya Suri, but at the same time, too, he's doing a lot of stuff, working with the police, working with the Israeli army, getting his high school degree. For those who saw Rabbi Goldzik's post on the internet, he's a wonderful bongo drummer. So that's how he's interacting with the world. You know, he's multitasking at his level, and hopefully this is just the beginning of his life of multitasking, because truly a life worth living, but still, we can multitask. Not that we should be overwhelmed by our multitasking, but we should be able to do more than just one thing. Dennis?
Yes, I believe, and I have a different view, I guess, than a lot of people, or maybe I have the same view, I don't know. But I believe every human has a level of confidence. And based on that level of confidence, that shows your typical behavior. But my viewpoint is not from the adult to the Down syndrome child. It's from the Down syndrome child to the adult. And that is, I believe, that anybody who has some imperfections is aware. They themselves are aware of these imperfections. How? I don't know. But I believe the mind can tell them that, and their mind doesn't stop working. So based on that, they don't have a lot of confidence because they're aware they're not exactly the same as other people based on behavior, based on speech, based on a whole bunch of things. In other words, their mind is working. So you may think they're not smart, but their mind is working. So you cannot go ahead and just discount the human mind of a child, a growing child, or an adult who's gone through all sorts of configurations of this, that, and taunts, and you name it, it just goes on and on. But what happens is they are usually overly polite, and they don't usually take the first action because they're not confident. We have to build up confidence in them to motivate them, to show them that their mind can handle these things, and to go forth and actually practice it on a physical basis, not just mental. So based on the level of confidence, people act and react to things. So it takes them a while to build up confidence, because if they know their imperfection and understand it, they don't know the secret of how to get past it, because they accept it. So they usually tend to be very, very meek. When you go to meet them, introduce them, they don't put out their hand first. Normally, you put out your hand and they will follow it, because they are feeling not completely confident. But when they do, they can act and be in a human environment and just fall into the human condition like everybody else does.
Beautiful, Dennis. We're going to now read from our last section today. Language learning opportunities. When babies make referential eye contact and draw the adult's attention to what they're doing, the adult tends to talk and give the baby the words to describe what they are doing or thinking about. So the baby's skill at referential eye contact may influence the amount of language learning opportunities experienced. Studies by Olwyn Jones from 1980 have shown that babies are not always skilled at turn-taking. That's for sure. Some adults are not good at are skilled at turn-taking. They tended not to leave predictable pauses when babbling and vocalizing, making it difficult for their mothers to contribute to the conversation. And this may also have a negative effect on a language learning opportunity. So what I'm taking from this, Dennis, is that when we are in a conversation with human beings of all ages, we have to be considerate of where is their level of turn-taking in the dialogue, whether it be body language, facial language, the tone of voice, the amount that they're speaking. And truly, the person who is skilled in having the patience to have an effective conversation with a baby as well as a child, as an adolescent, with a young and older adult, is truly someone who has not only facilitated a positive communication between human being number A and human being number B, from A and B, the two human beings, but they're also going to be able to strengthen and empower the other person to learn how to communicate better. Your take on this?
Well, again, this goes back to the level of confidence, because how many people would go up to somebody who has a Down syndrome, if they knew they had a Down syndrome, and would say to them, well, what do you think about that? Or what do you think about this? Normally, other beings don't do that. They think that they're going to embarrass them, or they're going to hurt them, or make them feel bad if they draw them into a conversation, a normal conversation. So you have to build up their confidence so that they can express themselves, whether they make sounds, whether they smile, whether they utter some words and want to do some more words, but they are not... let's put it this way. History says they're not practicing conversationalists. They are people who are usually left in the corner of a room, and a lot of people ignore them. By ignoring them, they're not participating in normal human behavior. So what happens is you have to go out of your way to draw them into a conversation so that you can see that it either motivates them, their eyes light up, or they feel like they have to say something. And that's when you want. That's when you got to get that moment when they feel like they have to express their views on whatever the conversation is going on, because they're constantly listening and trying to understand. And you never know the depth of their understanding. But the trick is never underestimate them, because their minds don't shut down.
Thank you, Dennis. With that, I'd like to thank you very much for participating in today's program, which I felt was another, I would say fiery, meaning, when I mean fiery, meaning we're not trying to burn bridges or burn down the city, but rather we're trying to share the enthusiasm, share the longing to facilitate greater understanding of an eclectic gathering of issues today, from the prison system to how a Rebbe talked about what his experience was in prison, what is the evil of prison, what the good that be gleaned out of prison, how does that apply to the service of the righteous souls of the creation, how does this relate to communication, how does it relate with empowering human beings who have what is known as disability, which Rabbi Goldsack is so accustomed to saying, being handicapable. So Dennis, if you'd like to sum up with perhaps whatever you feel, or share with our blessed audience, whether listening to us live or the future archive version, what's a nugget of wisdom you could share with our blessed listening audience that they can take and integrate into their lives today?
Well, this is not a good idea, but based on the current events of people being killed during Bible class, I mean... couldn't you wait till they step out of the church or the building? You have to use a gun while Bible service is being discussed. I like to remind everybody that evil is everywhere. And always be aware of that, even if you're in Bible class. I'm sorry, evil doesn't go away because you're talking about good things.
It's a very sobering point, Dennis, and may we pray And may our prayers be accepted that anyone who wants to seek out God, the Creator, and fellowship with other human beings should always be protected from such evil. And may that evil be eradicated in its thought process, that the individuals who would otherwise be prone to doing evil will be redirected with their thoughts to do good things within the creation. I'd just like to remind everyone there is a way that you can contribute, because, again, this material we accessed today was via the Heart to Heart website, and that there is a way that you can, in fact, help Rabbi Goldstock and his wife, Avala Chana Tova, empower human beings over in the Holy Land. And in a moment, I'm just going to type up there, and I apologize to Rabbi Goldstock. I don't remember verbatim the contact number, but we're just pulling it out, and then we're going to segue out with, of course, our favorite music from Brother David Dohm, who helped us get back home to help us realize our tzelem elokim is no dream, our divine image helps us get off in scrimmage. So again, you can contact Rabbi Goldstock via in America at 718-778-0111, and you can tell how much you'd like to, big or small contributions. He is open because, of course, and also they are a tax-free organization dedicated to the public good, whether it be in Israel or all around the world, because he does get phone calls and is consulting people day and night from all around the world how to deal with their uniquely abled children, adolescents, young and older adults. Also, you can go to online to their website at www.hearttoheartamerican.org/donations.html. And now, without further ado, music from our fellow Jew, David Dohm. We've played this music before, but it gets on the board to score. This is Instead of Your Fears. Blessed souls, just remember, and I'm hocking you, Chanukah, now I know it seems like I'm hitting you on the head verbally and emotionally and cognitively and spiritually. You've got to do good. The reason why you've got to do good, because the Teva Tov Lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good. The Creator is the source of all good. So the Creator wouldn't have created you except for the manifest in your own microcosmic world and life experiences to the greater macrocosmic eternal universe that the Creator has created, that you can do that good. It's okay if you've made a mistake in the past. Okay, repent, get close to the Creator, make a resolve not to go back into that silliness. But here, now, instead of your fears, David Dohm is going to help us consider what else we can engage in. In the meantime, blessed souls, I just want to mention to everyone that at 2 o'clock today in Crown Heights at 1433 President Street at Beit Mazal, the Sephardic congregation, I will be giving a live class on 7 Noahide Commandments. Admission is free. We'll be serving light refreshments. And hope to be joining us as well will be Ben Noah scholar Ron Williams. Take care, everyone. Instead of your fears, wipe away your tears.
Instead of your fears, count your blessings. when there's so much pain. Words fall like snowdrops, flood waters down the drain. Still the words are spoken, and Buddha still remains. Fix the heart that's broken, put it back together.